Many remember too well the ugliness, hatred, and violence unleashed after September 11, 2001, against Muslim, South Asian, and Arab people. It wasn't only mean-spirited individual bigots. The state itself, in the form of the FBI and INS, caught up hundreds of men and accused them of terrorism with no justification beyond their ethnicity or race, religion, or immigration status. Not everyone accepts that the abrogation of human rights and the rule of law is just stuff that happens in a time of crisis, and people, including our next guest, have been fighting for justice for these men for years, calling to account not low-level rule followers, but the rule makers, including former Attorney General John Ashcroft. Here to bring us up to date on the ongoing case known as Turkmen v. Ashcroft is Rachel Mirapol. She's senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Counterspin, Rachel Mirapol.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, listeners may not have heard very much at all about this case, so if you would first tell us the basic grounds for it and for the selection of defendants.
Absolutely. So the Center for Constitutional Rights filed Turkmen v. Ashcroft in 2002 when the 9/11 detentions were still ongoing. As most people may recall, shortly after 9/11, hundreds of Arab and Muslim men were swept up off the streets of New York and New Jersey. The FBI had opened up a tip line after 9/11, and hundreds and thousands of people called in with tips like, my neighbor's Arab and he keeps strange hours. I think he must be a terrorist. And on that level of information, the FBI and the INS would investigate the individual. And if in the course of that investigation, it became clear that the man was here in violation of the civil immigration law, maybe had overstayed his visa or was working without permission, he was arrested and held in connection to the terrorism investigation, treated as a suspected terrorist until cleared by the FBI and the CIA of any involvement in terrorism, and then deported. And many of the individuals arrested in this way were held in just outrageously restrictive conditions of confinement in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. There they were abused by guards, they were held in solitary confinement, locked in their cells 23 to 24 hours a day, denied the ability to practice their religion, to communicate with the outside world. These detentions went on for months after 9/11, until eventually everyone was cleared and deported, and not a single detainee was found to have had any involvement with 9/11. So the Center for Constitutional Rights brought the case to challenge the detentions, the religious profiling and racial profiling that led to the detentions, and the way these men were treated while they were detained. And we sought not just to go after the government officials who ran the Metropolitan Detention Center and the correctional officers who were individually responsible for beating our clients and the other detainees and for treating them so terribly, but also the architects of the policy, former Attorney General John Ashcroft, the former director of the FBI Robert Mueller, and the former commissioner of the INS James Ziegler, who all formulated the plan to profile individuals, to arrest them in connection to the terrorism attacks, and to hold them in these incredibly punitive conditions of confinement in hope that this would lead to information about other potential terrorists.
Well, so it may have meaning as an exemplar, but it's not a symbolic case. These are real harms done to real people, you know, and real people are responsible.
Well, that's absolutely the case. And our clients have spent over a decade now fighting for their day in court, seeking compensation for the ways in which their lives were completely destroyed, in the hopes that that would allow them to sort of put their lives back together again, to get over what has happened. And they don't just care, though, about compensation for themselves. The clients, the former 9/11 detainees, also really see this as a case to ensure that this kind of suspicionless, baseless religious and racial profiling doesn't happen again, that it doesn't go unpunished. You know, if we cannot hold the high-level architects of discriminatory policy and abuse accountable, what is to keep it from happening again and again?
Well, so what happened then in June at the Second Circuit Appeals Court? I think, you know, some folks may be surprised that the case has got as far as it has, but the appeals court ruling was interesting and, I guess, encouraging. What happened there?
That's right. We've just had an amazing victory after so many years of struggling here. The appellate court reinstated our claims against the three high-level officials and held that we should be allowed to move forward to discovery against these individuals to find out the details of what actually happened, who ordered what. This came after the district court had dismissed all of our claims against the three high-level officials. So this was really a sea change in the way that the courts are looking at the ability of individual civil rights plaintiffs to hold highest-level government officials accountable. While there has always been the theoretical possibility that an individual can sue, you know, a cabinet-level official for money damages for unconstitutional actions, it's incredibly hard to actually move forward in a case like that. I don't think it's ever happened that civil rights plaintiffs have gotten discovery against cabinet-level officials. It just doesn't happen, and that's because it's so hard at the beginning of a case to have enough facts at your disposal to explain how these high-level people were actually involved in violating your individual rights. That's not something that civil rights plaintiffs generally have access to. Because we've been involved in this case for so long and because we were lucky enough to have some initial discovery against the United States about the 9/11 detentions, and also because those detentions were documented so thoroughly in two Office of the Inspector General reports, you know, this is a rare situation where civil rights plaintiffs pre-discovery, or before the completion of discovery anyway, have enough detail to get a court to say, okay, you've pled plausible claims that these high-level officials violated your constitutional rights. Let's move forward.
That seems to be where other cases have foundered. In Ashcroft v. Iqbal, they said he didn't have enough details about the wrongs done to him. I guess it was really about the connection between John Ashcroft and the wrongs done to him was the problem, just drawing that line all the way up.
That's absolutely right. And so in Turkmen, we amended our complaint after that Supreme Court ruling in Iqbal to add the detail that the Supreme Court said was necessary to move forward against defendants of this nature. And so this is really the continuation of that battle.
Well, the dissenter in that circuit court appealing, the dissenting judge said, it's difficult to imagine a public good more demanding of decisiveness or more tolerant of reasonable, even if mistaken, judgments than the protection of this nation and its people from further terrorist attacks. I can see that, you know, echoing in the minds of many people. It certainly, though, begs the question that these were reasonable judgments. You know, if a tall man commits a crime, we likely wouldn't see a roundup of all the tall men in the area as reasonable, you know? So it has something to do with who these people were.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think that's the question at the heart of this case. You know, does the American public stand behind the idea that Muslims are suspicious because of their religion? Can we hold non-citizens to a different standard of justice than citizens? Does the fact that an individual is out of status mean they can be swept up and treated abusively in the hopes that maybe they might somehow have some information to share? Certainly, white citizens in this country don't face that kind of treatment. It's our belief, and it's our client's belief, that that kind of profiling cannot be the basis for rational law enforcement. It's not simply that it doesn't work, and it doesn't, but it's also that it is completely amoral and unconstitutional.
We've been speaking with Rachel Mirapol of the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can learn more about this case and their work at ccrjustice.org. Thank you very much, Rachel Mirapol, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.